You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we've got a very local slant today because my guest is Ellie Seymour, whose book Shop Girls details the lives of the women who worked in Haworth, which was once a very grand department store in Cambridge. So we'll be talking to her about that. We've also got interviews with biographer and novelist Julia Blackburn and author John Mullen. So Ellie, welcome to the studio. Nice to have you here. I'm going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but I wanted to talk to you first just because it's a theme that pervades a lot of the interviews that we've got today, this theme of nostalgia and how you recreate the past honestly. But was it as innocent in the past as we like to think it was, or are we seeing it through rose-tinted glasses? What do you think?
No, I think it was innocent, and many of the stories reflect that. And I think that's why nostalgia is so much enjoyed by everybody today.
Because the stories of the women in your book, there is an innocence about them, the dating, the hand-holding, certainly around the idea of relationships.
Absolutely. And Irene's story is lovely, for example, my second lead shop girl. She was in an isolation hospital recovering from measles, and a matchmaking matron said to her, "My dear, why don't you go out for a walk, get some fresh air, get some colour in your cheeks?" She'd been there for a week recovering from measles. And matchmaking matron then said to a handsome chap there who was in the Navy, "Why don't you go out and join that lovely waff that's just gone for a walk?" And that's how they got together.
Yes, that's not something that would happen these days. And the courtship was it in that one that the courtship was very long and mostly through letters?
He wrote, he was then sent to Burma while Irene was posted back to RAF Scampton, where her duties included kitting out the heroic crew before they departed on the Dambusters raid. And Peter wrote to Irene every day from Burma, and he wrote the most exquisite loving letters, really heartfelt letters. And the letter with the proposal of marriage is included in the book. And I can't believe that people still write letters like that today.
Well, they probably don't do this. All email or text nowadays.
That's the thing.
It's going to be increasingly hard for people like you researching the past, I think, therefore, to find out the real character of people, because these emails and texts just disappear. Well, we'll come back. And we'll talk more about the shop girls and the shop itself. But we're going to play your first piece of music now. I'm going to get this name wrong. The track is Okamus, and the artist is big breath, Mikis Theodorakis.
Theodorakis.
Ah, lovely. You did it best.
It's called Sorrow.
And why have you chosen this one?
Well, because my mother is Greek. Her name is Leluda Tatiana, and she was 16 when she married my father. He was stationed in Salonika during the war, and his name is Wilfred Williams. So very, very English. And my mother is the most beautiful singer, and she always sings this to me, and I play it to her. And it's a song that I will always remember my mother with.
You're listening to Bookmark, and that was Mikis Theodorakis, I think, probably pronounced wrong, but the first choice of music from my studio guest today, Ellie Seymour. Ellie is author of The Shop Girls. Published last year, The Shop Girls was listed in the Sunday Times Brilliant Book List of 2014 and was their number two bestseller in the biography section. It tells the story of Haworth's, an upmarket department store in Cambridge that closed in the mid-60s, and it also tells the stories, as we heard, of the women who worked in the shop. So, Ellie, how did you find the story of Haworth's?
Well, when I initially had the idea of writing a book about shop girls, following the huge interest in Mr. Selfridge on TV and The Paradise, which I both adored, I initially thought about writing about shop girls who worked in Eden Lily, which closed in 1999, because my husband had worked there as a buyer since leaving school himself, and he put me in touch with some shop girls. But all the ladies I spoke to had worked there in the 80s and 90s, and I needed to speak to ladies who covered those vintage years from the 40s, 50s and 60s, the era that everybody loves reading about. And so one of the shop girls I spoke to, Eve, who worked at Eden Lily, she had originally started working at Hayworth as a 14-year-old schoolgirl. And she told me about her work there and her experiences. And she then put me in touch with Betty, and Betty then put me in touch with Irene. And then the ball started rolling. And I realised that the more I heard these stories, I realised how special they were and how perfect they were for my book. And that this was really a gem of a store, a kind of store that just no longer exists anymore.
I was going to say, is there an equivalent today of Hayworth to try and picture it in our imagination?
Certainly not in Cambridge. So it was an independent store run by a very entrepreneurial, innovative and very complex man called Herbert Hayworth in the latter years. He took over from his father, George Hayworth, who opened his first Hayworth store in Burley Street, numbers 8, 9 and 10 in 1914.
And describe it to us. It was on the Hayworth that you focus on was on Sydney Street. How many floors was it? If we'd have gone in, what would it have felt like? I know you've got pictures. There was a big staircase, wasn't there?
A lovely sweeping staircase, deep maroon carpet. And so Hayworth's is on the corner of Sydney Street and Market Passage. It was opposite Joshua Taylor, and Eden Lily was at the end of the passage. And it had seven large windows and three floors of departments. And so it was very big, and it's where Trailfinders, Office Angels and Paul Ryman's is today. So if you stand back there and look up, you'll see the brickwork and you'll see just how big it was. And the store closed in 1965 and had all but faded from living memory until I started to research it and write about it.
And it was a very upmarket store, wasn't it? People got very individual attention when they went, and even during sales time you were allocated a sales assistant.
Yes, it was a very upmarket store, and the most upmarket customer was the Marchioness of Cambridge, who lived in Great Abington and was related by marriage to the royal family. And she would go in and order hats to be made specially. So what set Hayworth's apart from its rivals was its millinery workroom, which was up in the attic. And so this was run in the era I covered by Mrs. Pugh. And Mrs. Pugh would make hats for customers, because in those days, everybody bought a hat. All the smart ladies bought a hat to match their new outfit. And on one occasion, the Marchioness ordered five new hats to be made for each consecutive race day at Ascot. And what she would do, she would go and buy her dresses, cheaper dresses at Marks and Spencer, and they had very generous hems in those days, and she would cut off some of the fabric and take that into the store, and so they could match the colour with to make the hat specially for her. And she would sit in the royal box at Ascot, and her hats were very much admired by the royal family, I'm told.
And so it's a very bespoke service indeed. Mm. And the ladies themselves, the shop girls, how did you find them?
Well, once I spoke to Eve, Eve was at Eden Lily, and so she was like one of many people that I'd contacted through my Eden Lily sources from my husband. And she put me in touch with Betty. Betty put me in touch with Irene, and then they were still in touch with other shop girls who work there. And also I had a piece in the newspaper. Mike Petty wrote an article, and that's how I got Rosemary, my youngest shop girl. And I ended up speaking to more than 20 shop girls and friends who'd knew the family and had worked at Hayworth's. And the more I found out about him, the more interesting it became.
And did they think their stories were interesting?
No, I think that was the biggest challenge, because for them, It was just an ordinary working life. Like you imagine shop girls today, you probably don't give them a second thought when you go in and buy an item. But it's putting it in context with social history and what's happening around Cambridge at that time. And that fascination with that era, because life today is just so different. Working life is different, family life. And that's what made it so interesting. And they all loved Mr. Selfridge. And I shared their stories with each other. And so once they read what the other shop girls were saying, they thought, yes, that's interesting. I didn't realise my life was so interesting to others as well. And so they soon became very engaged.
Oh, well, thank you, Ollie. Well, we'll come back to you and we'll talk more about the individual women and the shop itself. But it's talking about interesting lives there. It's time now to hear from Julia Blackburn. Julia is a novelist and non-fiction writer. In 1996, her novel, The Book of Colour, was shortlisted for the Orange Prize. And 3 years later, her second novel, The Leper's Companion, also made the Orange shortlist and was nominated for the James Tate Black Memorial Prize. Her non-fiction writing has included memoir and biography, and her latest book, Threads, The Delicate Life of John Craske, weaves together the extraordinary story of the Norfolk fisherman and artist who lived for months at a time in a stupor state, and Julia's own life and the declining health and eventual death of her husband Herman. She came recently to Toppings in Ely to talk about Threads, and I asked her then when she'd first encountered the work of John Craske.
I encountered the name of him first, because I'd never heard of him, and a friend of mine, a painter, mentioned him and said that he was very interesting to see, and so I went hunting for him, going first to the Snape Maltings, where they have a collection, but not on show. They brought all the paintings out in a rather dark and strange room, and then I turned them round one by one and saw them, the paintings and the embroideries. And then I went to the North Norfolk coast to Glamford behind Cromer, where they have a long embroidery pinned up against one wall in this little museum called the Shell Museum, and one painting. And they very kindly lent me a stepladder so I could go up the stepladder and see the embroidery better and take photos of it. And those two encounters started me off on the quest for somebody who was very hard to find.
Yes, you say in your book, all I can find is evidence of his absence. What do you mean by that?
For me, the curious challenge of doing this book was that it was writing a biography about somebody about whom very, very little and sometimes nothing is known. John Craske had this brief flurry of fame, if that was what it was, in the 1930s. But after that, he died in 43, and then he pretty well disappeared without trace, although there was at least one collection was left in Snape. So there was no reason for people to save his work. And things got lost and mislaid, and papers got shuffled about and lost. Wherever I went, it was people saying, I mean, you know, either they hadn't got anything or what they had was in a cupboard, but they didn't know where it was, that kind of thing. And so it was the evidence of the absence. Within that absence, I could find a different sort of presence, if that makes sense.
Do you think he didn't want to be found?
No, I don't think that at all. I think it was just that he was a poor man, he was a fisherman, but crucially became an invalid, and crucially it was his physical state made it impossible for him to do anything much. And the painting and later the embroidery he did was what he did with his waking hours. Having said that, he does have a sense. He says he'd like to be shown in America, and he wanted his one work to go to the Norwich Castle Museum, so he had some sense of surviving his own life.
So what was your motive in writing the book? Did you just want to get to the bottom of his illness? Did you want more people to find out about him?
I more and more find that haphazardness is an interesting theme. And so with this, it was just the idea of looking, rather like you go into a junk shop and you look, you don't know what's there, but you see what catches your eye. And I liked the idea of looking at what he'd looked at, seeing what he'd seen, seeing the paintings and seeing what they told me, and then bit by bit accumulating anything that went around it. And I did like the idea of someone who painted and later embroidered in order to keep themselves sane is too extreme, but to keep themselves steady, that it was his way of thinking and his way of being. And so he was absolutely not concerned to have people coming to shows or to sell and be sort of praised. He was just concerned with making art because it kept him alive. I've always found that a very interesting thing, and that he wasn't somebody self-consciously making. He was somebody who stepped back and allowed the work to make itself, and that also is something which to me is an interesting, fascinating process, and one that I respect very much. Yeah.
And allowing the work to make itself, and this is a very personal book for you because your husband died while you were writing it, and you talk about that loss. How comfortable were you with that?
It wasn't a question of being comfortable or not comfortable. My husband had been involved with the first 2 years of working on the book, I suppose it was. So he'd come with me, or if he hadn't come with me on my trips to here and there, at least he was there when I came back and we'd talk about it, and he read the book as it went along, and he was very excited by it. And it's rather like if you have a, you know, if you're writing something and then there's an earthquake or there's a, your house burns down, that is part of who you are. So you can't then, I couldn't have gone on with the book without writing the way that my world had changed, in which I was looking for John Krask. And I mean, at first I couldn't do anything, but after 3 months, I slowly got back to picking up the thread of where I'd left off. I had, right at the beginning of getting back to it, this very strange thing. I'd been busy with thoughts of time with the writing of the book, partly because of using the fact that Einstein was living nearby to Krask at one point in 1933. I've always been interested in non-linear time. And then with this, I was aware that my husband had died in October 2013, and John Krask was still alive in my book. And this then was part of the process of the writing, of pulling the past into the present in order to move on. It pulled me through the first year in a way that I was really glad for, and it was also a conversation with my husband in his absence, as well as a conversation with John Krask in his absence.
And even before your husband died, you were finding connections between your own life or your own experiences and the life of John Krask. Does that always happen to you when you write?
I always mean it not to, but it always does. I think that every book that I've written, I find this overlap of my own life. I don't believe in objectivity, I suppose, but it's not that I want to push a kind of subjective thing, but just the incidents of my own life, the incidentals, perhaps, of my own life, are part of the process of the making of the book. Because there was nothing known about John Krask, I was then following myself as I followed very often pointless or unexpectedly leading research expeditions to go and see if I could find people who remembered him or going to places that he'd have seen. So that was already autobiographical, if you like, because it wasn't me being an historian. It was me being myself going on strange journeys to see where they led.
And do you think the form of biography is evolving? Because before, biographies used to be from cradle to grave, literally, whereas now they tend to, as you say, you've played around with time, you involved your own personal experience in it. Do you think it's a more open form than it once was?
I'm not a professional to be able to say that, but I think that I, for instance, have a very strong kinship with Montaigne, with the French philosopher, or with Sir Thomas Brown, the Religio Medici man, that what is interesting to me is to follow one's own thought processes within the context of research. And I think it is that, yes, we've lost the sense that there is a truth, both in history and in biography. And I find that more and more, that I, in my life, in everything, I don't feel that there is a good or a bad, a truth or an untruth. It is just finding a way through things. And there is nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so, as Hamlet said. And that I would agree with him. And it's just the thinking which is the process of the writing.
And I wanted to talk to you about Laura Krask, because in many ways she comes through as one of the real heroes of the book for me. What did you think of Laura?
Well, she was interestingly unwilling to be part of it in her own bits of writing. There were little things that she wrote about her husband. And there's one bit where she says, "I'll tell you everything that I can remember, but you must leave me out of it at all times." She's the presence always there. And obviously with somebody like him who was so ill, in the things like when he was ill for 3 years without apparently getting out of bed, or hardly getting out of bed, she says in a little tiny incidental in a letter that she never left the house in all those 3 years. So you see that she was dedicated to him, that her life was his life. I have no idea how she would have been to meet, but everybody always said, oh, she was shy, she didn't speak. And Sylvia Townsend Warner, the writer who collected Krask's work, also said that she was pretty well silent. But there is something that she was obviously a perfect partner for him. And the two of them got on with their strange, often silent life. And she obviously, at every step of his work, She was there helping him, loved the work with a passion.
I really enjoyed reading your book, but it's not one to read in a Kindle because the Kindles scrunch up the pictures and they're in black and white. So how would you describe the pictures to me?
The book itself, I thought of halfway through, I thought that this is more like painting a picture or embroidering a big image because of going from, you know, sort of one thing to the next in the writing. And the visuals of the book are in conversation with the text, so that it's not only illustrating it with work by John Krask of these wonderful little paintings which kept on appearing. It's not only his things, but it's also the pictures that I took while I was rumbling around in small circles looking for him. It's an accumulation of image which I hope then reflects the accumulation of thinking.
And how would you actually describe the artwork itself?
Well, it was interesting that people very easily say, oh, is he like Alfred Wallace? But actually, more and more, I think he's not like Alfred Wallace at all, except that they were both poor fishermen who were busy with memory of the sea when they couldn't actually go on the sea. When you look at his work, we just had this exhibition opening in Norwich, and when you see it in the dignity of a beautiful gallery, I can't quite say what it is, but it's got a tremendous integrity about it. And it's also got, I think, a very strong artistic quality, that some of the details of the embroideries have a thing, they're like, they're more impressionist. And the ones of the paintings of the boats, there's something that Sylvia Townsend Warner says. She says that he paints like a man speaking under oath. And that intensity of integrity you see in the work, and when you see them with this dignity of seeing them in a proper exhibition, they really sing tremendously.
And finally, Julia, what's your next subject?
I've got a very vague project, which my publishers are with in theory, called Angels Dancing on a Pin, and another even vaguer one, which would be a... I can't even put words to it, except that haphazardness is my great strength at the moment. So it's two things that would be following on this idea of following trains of thought with the world around as the sort of trigger for the thinking.
That's Julia Blackburn there talking about her book Threads, The Delicate Life of John Krask. My studio guest on Bookmark today is Ellie Seymour. Ellie, Julia was talking there about haphazardness and where her leads and her characters and her story led her. When you were researching the Shopgirls and the Haywards, you uncovered something that you weren't expecting. That's right, a secret child.
Yes, I uncovered a big family secret. So as anyone who goes to the Ancestry.com website might know, when you start looking up a family, if your name there is linked, and so anyone else who goes to the same site will know that you are researching that particular family. And that's what happened with us. So I had somebody help me with this research. I wanted to know why George Haworth had come to Cambridge, because he was a Lancashire man from Burnley, and his roots were in the cotton mill industry. So I was fascinated to find out more about his background. And what I discovered was that his son Herbert had a first marriage that nobody knew about. So on the face of it, Marjorie Bass, who was a widow of a Cambridge law academic, was Herbert's wife. So they married after the Second World War, and she had a son from her first marriage, and everybody thought that Marjorie was Herbert's one and only wife. And she was a very beautiful, elegant, refined and educated woman. She was the perfect hostess for their very lavish, generous parties, which they were renowned for in Cambridge, because the Haworths mixed with all the movers and shakers of the time. So the Marshalls from Marshalls Airport, the Heffers from the bookstore, so the family who ran Vogue and Medice, the Harris family, and George became president of the Rotary Club. They were all Rotarians and Freemasons. So nobody knew that Herbert had been married during the Second World War to a woman called Pamela Coyle. And he abandoned her just before their first son was born, their only son, called Paul Hales. So they both remarried their new partners on exactly the same day, coincidentally. But Herbert had never had anything to do with Paul in his entire life. And Paul was only told on his 21st birthday that the man he thought was his father was in fact his stepfather, and that he'd been adopted by him. And in those days, you just accepted that kind of news. His mother refused to talk about it, and it was brushed under the carpet. And I met Nepal, so his sister-in-law was researching his family roots as well, his biological father. And so we met up, and for the first time, at the age of 70, Paul is now 70, I was able to show him photographs of his real father and tell him about the family he never met, never knew. So it was a very, very emotional moment. And the reason we think that this was kept from Paul and for the divorce is that basically the Hayworths had become snobs. So they were a very poor, hardworking family to start with. And now they're mixing with the elite. He's flying shop girls and his friends off to Paris for the day, chartering private planes from Marshalls, taking his friends to shopping and the theatre, and having a very generous, extravagant lifestyle, you know, quite different to what Paul's were. And I think that at the end of the war, when Herbert was demobbed, he came back to live with his parents, who were living in Hurst Park Avenue then. So they'd started off in Cambridge, living above the shop, which lots of shopkeepers did in those days, so at the beginning of the 20th century, and this was in Burley Street. And then after that, they lived in Mill Road, which the Petersfield end. And then they lived in Hurst Park Avenue. So you can see how they climbed the social ladder. And when George handed over the business to Herbert, he probably said, I'm giving you this business and you need to make a fresh start with a fresh wife who's going to be perfect for you. And that was the reason why.
But you were able to give Paul some crumb of comfort, weren't you, from an anecdote that one of Herbert's friends had given you?
Yes, well, Herbert was so rich. They had an apartment just off Oxford Street in London as well. And he also ran a furrier business there. So he stored fur coats for very rich ladies. And Hayworth sold fur coats too. Marjorie was often seen swanning in wearing long fur coats. Many of the shop girls told me that. So Herbert's best friend was Richard Tothill, who ran the great Chesterford Country Club. And his daughter, Sandy, told me this very sad story, that they're driving to Hove, through Hove, to collect a fur coat, when suddenly they drive past a church and Herbert bursts into tears. He sobs and sobs and sobs. And the reason is because that's the church where he had married Pamela Coyle, and that was the church where his son was baptised, and the son he never knew or met, and that gave Paul some great comfort. It's the only sign he had that his father did still have feelings for him. And I think in those days it was just something he was told he had to put it behind him now and move on with his new wife and his new life.
But obviously it was there. Wow. I mean, that brings it home more than anything, how alive the past is in the present. Wow. Thank you for that story, Ellie. We're going to play now your second choice of music, which is the clarinet concerto from Mozart. Why have you chosen this one?
Well, because I hanker a desire to be an aspiring clarinetist, and playing the adagio from Mozart's clarinet concerto is my ultimate aim. And I started having lessons in 2005, but then I got heavily into blogging, and I ended up forsaking it for the sake of the internet, really, which is a terrible thing to do. And I'm determined one day to pick it up again. But I have had so much joy and pleasure from playing the clarinet, and it's a lovely instrument to play on your own. It can be tuneful on your own, and it's great to play with friends who play piano and other instruments too. So I can't wait to one day have the time in my life to be a clarinetist.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
And my guest today on Bookmark, my studio guest, is Ellie Seymour, author of The Shop Girls. And Ellie, you're going to read an extract from The Shop Girls now for us.
I am, yes. This will demonstrate how different life is on the shop floor today for shop girls. So. It was Friday afternoon, and Margaret's eye looked up at the sweeping staircase that led to the fashion showroom. Herbert Hayworth was standing there on a platform, casting his eyes over the departments, hands on hips, fixing his stare on the shop girls. Most of the junior shop girls had no direct contact with Mr. Hayworth, including Margaret. He wasn't as polite as his father, George, who'd seemed much more kindly when he had run the store. As she looked up at Mr. Hayworth, Margaret tried to avoid his direct gaze. She'd heard how a shop girl could be fired by Mr. Hayworth for no reason and would never know why. If the red light was on outside his office on a Friday afternoon, that was a fair indication that someone had been called up and was going to be given their cards. While Mr. Hayworth could be charming to senior staff, he had a very strict and authoritative stance with those who were lower ranking and was feared by some of them. One Friday afternoon, Mr. Hayworth's gaze fell on Margaret. It was exactly what she had dreaded. "Can you step into my office, Miss Beebe?" he asked her. Margaret froze on the spot. "Right, that's it. I shall be out," she told her friends as she walked up the stairs. Her heart was thumping as she walked up the staircase, wondering what she could possibly have done wrong. The red line went on as she entered Mr. Hayworth's office. Margaret expected to hear the worst and resigned herself to being sacked without any cause or justification. Herbert Hayworth looked at Margaret's worried face and asked her, "Why are you looking so nervous? I'm not going to eat you." She was surprised. He was in a jovial mood, but Margaret said nothing, awaiting to hear her fate. "Look, you've been in millinery long enough and you're just the height we like for fashions," he told her. Margaret felt a great sense of relief. "What do you mean?" she asked, unable to grasp why she was moving departments. Mr. Hayworth felt that taller girls looked better in the fashion showroom, and he often used them to model some of the garments there. "Well, look, one of the shop girls has left fashions, and we'd like you to come and join them as you're tall, and you would fit in well there." "Well, yes, all right," she replied, stumbling over her words. It was not at all what she'd been expecting to be told. But it meant that Betty lost one of her shop girls to the fashion showroom. So that afternoon, when Betty, who rang the millinery department, returned from lunch, she was summoned to Mr. Hayworth's office. Mr. Clark, the office manager, told her that she must make her way there straight away. Even Betty was a little nervous of her boss. "Oh no, what have I done now?" she thought, worried that she was going to be in trouble. As she nervously entered his office, Mr. Hayworth's face was red. He was angry. He was furious, and Betty had no idea what had upset him so much. He slapped some cards on his desk, pointing at them, and said, "These are Mrs. Green's cards, and I want you to sack her." Betty gasped in surprise and asked, "But why? Whatever for? She hasn't done anything wrong." Herbert Hayworth stared at Betty. She'd rarely seen him so cross. "Well, she was leaning against some fixtures, and I don't pay people to lean against fixtures, so she can go straight away." Betty knew she couldn't argue with him. She picked up the woman's cards and walked out of the office. She felt dreadful, having to break such devastating news to Mrs. Green. She was in her 30s, and Betty felt sorry for her, knowing she had a broken marriage behind her, and she was living with another man and had recently suffered a miscarriage. Poor Mrs. Green, she often arrived for work looking pale and drained, but Betty never found fault with her work. It was just her misfortune to have been seen slouching by Mr. Hayworth when he walked through the millinery department, instead of standing straight and alert, which he insisted upon.
Goodness me, there'd be nobody left in shops nowadays if you were fired for slouching. He did have very high standards, didn't he?
He did. And it was very much like upstairs, downstairs in many ways. And the girls knew their boundaries, and they knew the formalities that were expected of them and the courteous way they had to always behave with customers.
But in return, they were paid very well. They were often offered help with childcare. It seemed to me, and they did get Saturdays off, and that was often a bit of a nuisance for them.
No. They didn't get the Saturdays. That was the one thing. That was the one reason that most of the shop girls left. But Herbert did pay better than lots of other stores. All the shop girls told me he was very, very generous. So Irene was one of his favourite shop girls, and she left four times for different reasons. And each time he rang her and invited her back. And on one occasion, he offered to give her extra money to pay her housekeeper's costs after she'd had her daughter. And so Irene returned to work, and Herbert put this extra money in her pay packet each week. And her daughter, Jennifer, would go on buying trips with her to London, and Herbert paid all her travel costs as well. And he was very, very generous to Irene and very paternal as well to the shop girls. So when the store closed, he found jobs, new jobs for all of them.
Well, we're going to come back to that. We're going to come back to why the store closed and what happened then. But we're going to hear from John Mullen first. John Mullen is Professor of English at University College London. He's written a weekly column on contemporary fiction for The Guardian, reviews books for the London Review of Books, and was a judge for the Man Booker Prize in 2009. His own books cover a range of subjects, from 18th century popular culture to the creative writing MA Bible, How Novels Work. He came to Cambridge recently to speak to Campus, the Cambridge Publishing Society, about his book Anonymity, A Secret History of English Literature. I asked him then what first attracted him to the subject of hidden identity.
Well, I suppose it was something that grew on me over years and years of reading and teaching English literature. I just noticed how much of it, when you looked at something like the original title pages of the books, famous books often, that you were reading, how many of them were first published without their true authors' names on. And also, slowly I began to notice more and more how that was a rather important thing for the first readers. So there we were with all the sort of English literature alphabetically on the bookshelf, as it were. And yet so many of these great works of literature, the novels of Daniel Defoe and Jane Austen, the poems of Byron and Tennyson, first appeared with a sort of big question mark on them. That seemed a phenomenon that hardly anybody much talked about, and so that's what got me going.
So would readers, contemporary readers at the time, would they have known who these works were by?
Very often, no, they wouldn't have known. When Jane Eyre was first published, an autobiography by Currer Bell, they didn't know, the first readers, and it was a bestseller fairly quickly, who Currer Bell was. And more than that, reviewers immediately began to suspect, ordinary readers began to suspect that Currer Bell was a disguise. And therefore, they began to wonder who the real author was. And in a way, it was the sign of a success of a book, because, I mean, very many of the books first published without their author's names have never been attributed, really, because nobody was interested. So in a funny sort of way, the sure sign that your poem, your satire, your novel was a success was people started asking who wrote it.
But having a false name different to those names that just get lost, does it matter?
The attribution of the authorship of a work, I think, matters, because when we read, we inescapably wonder about the person who produced it. And I think we do that just as much when the thing we're reading is not autobiographical as when it is. Authors matter to us. It matters that Charlotte Bronte wrote Jane Eyre, not just because we may be fascinated by the experiences that went into it, and I think we are, not just because anybody who reads that novel must know that certain aspects of it came out of the observation and experiences of the author, but because we want to know about the skill, the inspiration, the genius behind it. It's really noticeable that the effect of anonymity throughout literary history has been to excite speculation. And a lot of authors have known that. So the funny thing is that the more I researched the topic, the more it seemed that authors who kept their identities hidden, a lot of the time wanted people to try to find out who they were. I mean, the cases where they were actually trying to remain hidden, there are such cases, but they're few and far between. Much more often, authors wanted people to guess. And there are records like, for instance, you know, Jonathan Swift, when he published Gulliver's Travels, went to huge lengths to conceal himself. He had a friend copy out the manuscript for him so that his handwriting wouldn't be recognised. He had somebody else take, swaddled in cloaks and broad-brim hats, the text of it to the publisher, the bookseller, as he was called in those days, so that even he didn't know whose work he was publishing. And yet, when he heard people speculate about the authorship, he was very irritated if they thought that anybody except him could have written it. And that's quite characteristic, that authors want to be found out.
And I suppose it's a phenomenon that's not gone away that much. If you look at the Robert Galbraith, J.K. Rowling, the last couple of years, is it something you associate with the past?
Yes. I think I associate it with the past in that before the 20th century, it was normal for works, particularly what we might call literary works, so particularly novels or books of poetry or satires, to appear anonymously. And that's partly because there was an old convention which sort of disappeared early in the 20th century, that it was sort of vulgar to put your name on something. You know, until the 18th century, it was thought to be improper to print your work at all by some people. You know, okay, maybe posthumously. So there was a great sort of elaborate game playing in the 17th century and the 18th century of authors pretending that their works had been published against their wishes. Somebody'd stolen the manuscript. All sorts of sort of wonderful room for manoeuvre. A lot of the time, these claims were rubbish. The authors had very carefully arranged the publication, but pretended that as sort of respectable gentlemen or ladies, it was against their wishes. Now, those sort of conventions did, I think, disappear in the early 20th century. So there was much less fun to be had, actually, for authors. It's quite common for authors who are very successful in one genre to publish in another genre under a pseudonym. Julian Barnes has a pseudonym for his detective novels. But I think those aren't real disguises. I mean, the J.K. Rowling one wasn't much of a disguise. It was a disguise that was designed to be broken through very, very quickly. The actual cases where widespread speculation is excited are quite rare nowadays. The best one, admittedly, it was perhaps 30 years ago, was the best-selling novel Primary Colours, which was later made into a film. And it was about Bill Clinton's campaign to be the Democrat candidate for president. And it was published as by anonymous. And the publisher, very 18th century, the publisher wasn't allowed to know who it was. All the texts and communications reached the publisher by fax machine. This was before emails, I think. It was top of the New York bestseller list, and apparently nobody knew who the author was. And the speculation about the authorship, I think, greatly helped boost interest in it and boost the sales, because the point was that it had obviously been written by somebody very, very close to the Clinton campaign. It was a roman à clef, so every character in it, although they had a fictional name, stood for a real, recognisable person. So the mystery about its authorship was part of its appeal. And that is a modern example, if you like, of a sort of old phenomenon. But I think those examples are quite rare.
Do you think now, in this age of social media, it's just impossible to keep anything secret?
Probably the most interesting examples nowadays are actually on the internet rather than, you know, in the world of books. Because another thing about the world of books is now authorship is so important as part of what sells a book. Publishers would take a lot of convincing that it would be a good idea for an author to actually conceal themselves. There'd have to be some very clever reason for it. And indeed, when a few years ago Doris Lessing, who was then a best-selling novelist, chose to publish some novels under a pseudonym, but it was a pseudonym that was announced to be a pseudonym, if you see what I mean. If you read the dust jacket, it said Jane Summers, who was a supposed author, is in fact a well-known London journalist, which is not true, she wasn't. But anyway, when she did that, of course, the books that she wrote hardly sold at all until a year or two on, they were announced to be Doris Lessing books, and then they started selling. So in the world of books, there's not so much of an incentive. I think there are cases, and there have been cases recently of anonymity and pseudonymity on the internet. Perhaps not very, perhaps scandalous rather than creative ones. There is still room for the exploitation of anonymity. You know, what it always relies on, as in the case I've just mentioned, is the sort of that old characteristic of readers, curiosity. You've got to arouse curiosity.
And what about you, John? Have you ever thought about writing under a pseudonym?
I have never thought of writing under a pseudonym. I wonder if there would be a reason. The one kind of writing under a pseudonym that I can sympathise with, although I will certainly never attempt it, is when people write, especially journalistically, in interesting ways about their personal lives. So when somebody writes a column about getting divorced, or there's one which I find gruesomely fascinating at the moment in The Guardian of a middle-aged woman doing internet dating. Yeah, you'd want that to be anonymous, I think. But I think that you would be mad to think your anonymity was going to stay forever.
That's John Mullen there talking about his book Anonymity. There's no anonymity here. Ellie Seymour, very much the author of The Shop Girls. And we were talking, Ellie, before John's interview about the closure of Haworths. Why did the shop close?
I think it closed because Herbert had bad health. He liked his food and drink. His face looked very bloated in the last photograph I have seen of him, which was taken on the 5th of November 1965, the last day of the store, when he handed out long service gifts to staff, so beautiful watches. And his face is very bloated then. And so Herbert then retired, and he travelled abroad. He had a home in Spain, in Lanfranc, and he lived there for a while, and he moved around other parts of Spain, I'm told, by his stepson, Nigel Bass. And he settled with Marjorie in Jersey, and this is at a time when only the very rich can live there. You have to be a millionaire. And sadly, Herbert died in 1969. He was only 53.
And it seems to me from your book that the girls, the women, never really replaced that experience of working at Haworths. They moved to other department stores in Cambridge, but they weren't the same.
No, they all said that. I think they recognise now, particularly now, looking back and talking about it with me, just how exceptional those days were.
And what about you? What's your next project now?
I'm researching a book I'm going to write about evacuees, so based on real events, but for inspiration. But I've gathered some amazing stories about the life of evacuees in Cambridgeshire.
And you, I know you use the Cambridgeshire Collection a lot. Is it a good source?
Yes, it's fabulous. In fact, recently I was put in touch with them again. Chris Jakes contacted me to say that Ramsey and Muspratt, who had taken photographs of Haworth's windows in the 1950s, they had now come into their possession. And it was the first time I was able to see what the store's windows looked like. And they were so elegant, and the detail was fabulous. And it was a real joy and a real treasure trove. And it was thrilling to see them there. And they're always very, very supportive and very, very helpful. And Mike Petty lives just around the corner from me, in fact. And he'd never heard of Haworth's either when I first started writing about it.
I'm sure there's room for a second edition of that book, Ellie, with those new photographs. Thank you very much for coming into the studio and talking to us about your book. Next, our next show It's the last show before we take a break for the summer. My studio guest then will be Big Issue founder and campaigner John Bird, and he'll be talking about his memoir. I've also got interviews with poet Elaine Hewitt and Peter Murphy, who's a Cambridge judge, and he's just written his latest espionage thriller. But we'll play out with your last choice of music, Ellie. Oh, wonderful. ABBA and Dancing Queen. Why this one?
Well, because whenever I hear this, it's so joyful and it's impossible not to dance to it. So everyone get up and dance.